Thank you all for coming here. So as was done in the last talk, and thank you very much for explaining what these are about, we would like to begin by acknowledging that we're speaking from the ancestral homelands and territories of the Nacotchtank and Piscataway peoples. We honor their legacy of spiritual and care and stewardship of the land, and the current ongoing legacy and care by the Piscataway peoples. So in the talk title, we say justice. So what is our case for justice here? We all can tell that anthropogenic change is a systemic change system problem. It's widespread. We have intersecting impacts to environmental systems at all scales. These cause positive feedback loops that accelerate systemic changes, which are synergistic with social and environmental injustices to marginalized human societies. The EPA, the White House Council on Environmental Justice, and the Council on Environmental Quality all define environmental justice as the just treatment and meaningful, and that's my emphasis, involvement of all people, regardless of their identities, where they come from, what their income levels are, what class they may be, in agency decision-making and federal activities that can impact human health and the environmental health, so that all people are going to be fully protected from disproportional and adverse impacts, regardless of where they are, and also the social legacies of racism and structural and systemic barriers. They should also be able to have equitable access to a healthy, sustaining, and resilient environment for all human, cultural, and spiritual activities. So why talk about diversity in this context? We all know that biodiversity builds healthier and more resilient ecosystems, both because it creates redundancy in the systems and because rather than having linear, fragile energy chains, you have overlapping energy webs. Human diversity does the same in social systems. We get better decision making, we have healthier relationships, we build sense of community and shared goals, and of course, people are part of nature. We are therefore part of biodiversity ourselves. And so these intersecting systemic changes to both the environment and to human societies are made worse by the lack or loss of diversity. So some examples from natural ecosystems, and you'll excuse me, please, by borrowing from my own work. But we can see cumulative systemic impacts where you have lots of things intersecting together. For instance, direct human impacts on the biodiversity by human behavior, like, say, forest degradation, climate change impacts of all kinds, ocean acidification, and in my case, the work you see here and down here, endocrine disrupting contaminants, plastics, plasticizers, what are very popular in the media right now is forever chemicals. These things all intersect so that you get combined exposure effects. This is often what's known as One Health work, and it really plays a role in both human and environmental societies and health. Similarly, lack of diversity in human societies. So when we get housing and land use policies that are rooted in structural racism, redlining, for instance, and depression or elimination of indigenous communities from their land, we get racial segregation, wealth and income disparities, and inequities in political power. And that creates what are known as sacrifice zones, where we get disproportionate siting of, say, industry or highways into those dispossessed communities. Wealthier communities, privileged communities benefit more from the pollution, access to goods, et cetera, while those dispossessed communities are regulatorily abandoned by the government. And that creates disparities in exposure to fossil fuel pollution, to community fragmentation, et cetera. And that creates a climate gap or an environmental gap where we get race and class disparities that are exacerbated by those changes to climate and environment. And we get unequal health impacts. So some core definitions before I go on, because I used the word systemic several times. And we often use system and systemic interchangeably, but they do have some differences. Systems are sets of interdependent interacting components or individuals where the effect of those interactions as a whole is greater than the sum of the parts. Those of you who have done AMP will recognize this. So systems change, sustainable directional changes to patterns of those interactions. For example, transforming policies and practices, or changing relationships and power dynamics. Systemic incorporates multiple systems interacting together. And so systemic change, you're changing the pattern of the interactions of multiple systems that all intersect and have synergistic impacts on each other. A good theory of change should define what the end change goals are and how those are going to be iterated. And it should explain both how by defining processes by which that change occurs, and why. Both why the change is necessary and why the processes work the way they do. So the theory of change we're presenting here says that we live in extractive economies. Probably a lot of you have heard of the tragedy of the commons, popularized by Hardin in 1969. There's a lot of problems with the tragedy of the commons, as he expressed them. For one, he blamed the very communities he was saying are minoritized. He said that they were causing the problem with extraction in the commons, and that if we just got rid of them, we'd be okay. So he was pretty racist in his explanation of it. But there's also a question of whether or not we should view natural resources as resources at all, and whether or not we should view human capital, human resources, as resources at all. Because when you live in an extractive economy and you're labeling groups of people and resources in nature, for instance, air, water, et cetera, as a resource, what happens in that extractive economy when those are resources? To change that, we need to get community-led solutions. We need to seed real power and real authority for decision-making that's actionable within those communities, so that they can create culturally relevant and place-based solutions. That allows them to create systems change at their own systems level by, say, switching those power dynamics, and therefore leads into systemic change at larger systems. Why focus on power? A lot of faith-based people are very uncomfortable with this language. Power is the ability of systems to limit diversity, but it's also the power or ability of systems to expand diversity and create change. To do this, power first must change to achieve broader systemic change flowing from historically advantaged communities to historically and currently minoritized communities, who can then use that power to create that change. Why focus on education? People who are going into the sciences and STEM as a broader field are first going to be educated in STEM. And currently, the majority of educators in educational systems show very low diversity, low inclusivity, and they tend to recruit internally. They tend to recruit people who came up just like they did and look just like they do. The majority of STEM educators were educated at primarily white institutes, primarily R1s, often Ivies. They have little experience with best educational practices. Their standards are often rooted in bias, and they lack culturally relevant and place-based teaching methodologies. They show little representation of the student body, and they tend to approach student identities and cultures with a deficit mindset as opposed to an asset mindset. As a result, learners and learning systems may be highly diverse, but they have a low sense of belonging, you get low retention, and the workforce tends to reflect that. If we change that so that educators and educational systems show high diversity and high inclusivity and recruit from exiting student pools, they would have degrees relevant to both field and teaching, training and best practices, standards rooted in student success, belonging, and persistence. use culturally and place-based relevant teaching methods and pedagogy, show high representation of and to their students, and approach student identities and culture with an asset mindset. That's how we also change the workforce. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Carlos.
Okay, thank you, Sharon. Hello, everyone. Again, my name is Carlos Martinez. I'm a AAAS Science Technology Policy Fellow at the National Science Foundation, and I'm a climate scientist. And what you see here is, or this portion of the presentation will be kind of providing us an example of what we mean by this theory of change and the work in providing a more inclusive STEM workforce and education. And so this is a part of a paper that just got published 3 days ago. Woo-hoo. And it's really exciting. It talks about the importance of including collaborating with faith-based understandings and indigenous knowledges in the geosciences. But a lot of what I'm sharing could be similarly applied to other STEM-related fields. Okay. Oh, I went the wrong way. There we go. Okay, so I first want to show this summary schematic. Related to what I describe as three ways of knowing. The first, which we traditionally can think about, is Western science or knowledge, which is predominantly within the weather, water, and climate enterprise. This includes, you know, operational forecasting, weather broadcasting, etc. You have, in addition, separately, indigenous knowledges, which are place-based knowledges that have human nature, relationships are very culturally specific. And then finally, faith-based understandings, where many faith communities have environmental pillars within their theological teachings, such as creation chair, eco-spirituality, and other human nature relationships. The idea here is that each way of knowing have, you know, their specific and distinct and unique systems of understanding our planet. But they all exist and have a shared space amongst these three, what I describe, main circles or pillars, which are environmental stewardship, environmental justice, and mental health. And despite this shared space, there is a significant gap in initiatives and relationships and collaboration amongst these three systems of knowing to work on and address various environmental issues. And education can be a bridge builder to bring these various knowledges together. Why is that important? Well, there are many students and professionals within the weather, water, climate community whom subscribe to non-Western ways of knowing, indigenous or faith-based, like many of us, for example, may subscribe to, providing a space for them to have this part of their identity be shared and known provides a sense of comfort and accessibility, but also relates well with the communities whom they serve, and can also be, in some aspects, ways to mitigate for many faith communities what are climate skepticisms and apathy amongst these climate and environmentally related issues. In addition to that, like perhaps many of us may subscribe to in our own scientific fields, we share beliefs and have a community membership with our respective faith communities where we can draw on our own experiences to share insights on the relationship between our subject technical matter expertise and also our faith. And this can be a great bridge builder for the communities whom we speak to, and consequently, they find a sense of trust to the speaker when sharing their insights and such. So what is being done? How are we able to promote inclusive engagement amongst scientists and professionals, for example, who subscribe to many ways of knowing, like myself and others? This is an example within the weather, water, climate community where I developed and lead a committee at the American Meteorological Society, which consists of 12,000 members, scientists, practitioners, National Weather Service personnel, your local weather broadcaster from your local news station, and students as well. This committee fosters a space to exchange ideas, networks, building relationships where people can feel comfortable to talk about their faith and spirituality within a scientific enterprise like the AMS. And we also facilitate dialogues between multi-faith organizations across the United States and with partners around the world on many areas on weather, water, and climate topics like resilience, justice, education, mental health, and others. And so what do we do specifically? We do a variety of webinars, which are publicly available, as well as sessions for upcoming and previous annual meetings for the AMS. We work with organizations like Green Faith, Interfaith Power and Light, the Indigenous Climate Action Network, and Creation Justice Ministries, all of whom are extremely eager to work with scientists in a variety of capacities. This past year in Baltimore, we had a fantastic multi-faith and spiritual community gathering at the annual meeting of the AMS, where we had over 100 participants from various U.S. Centers for Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships to the National Weather Service, to spiritual leaders across the Mid-Atlantic region, the Interfaith Partners of the Chesapeake, for example, Interfaith Power and Light, AAAS Dozer, and the Thriving Earth Exchange at the American Geophysical Union, all came together to have a conversation on ways that we can work with one another when it comes to resilience. And so that information's also available on our website, which has a bunch of information that goes into several of the activities that we've been able to do. And we also have a listserv, which any of you are more than welcome to be a part of. You do not have to be a member of the AMS to be a part of COSMOS, as we work with members and non-members across the weather, water, climate, and multi-faith communities to increase the exposure of this kind of work, to provide the accessibility of these conversations as well. But more specifically, tailored to the STEM education piece, we were able and fortunate to work with the University of Delaware to develop an inclusive and creative climate education workshop this past year. And this paper from Siders and Veron highlights the results and the findings from this workshop. We brought folks from a variety of perspectives, indigenous knowledge, for example, faith-based understandings, and practitioners, social and physical scientists, to talk about these various themes to be incorporated in K through 12 and collegiate education as it pertains to climate science. One is, of course, forging and deepening connections and fostering relationship building, what that means not only amongst one another in our respective belief systems, but also with our environment. Recentering that as well, building creativity. So, you know, graphs and charts can only go so far in communicating and learning what is happening to our planet, but there were conversations on ways to foster art, to foster, you know, different ways of learning that many students and even faculty appreciate to inform a more diverse way of educating on climate and related topics. And then storytelling. Storytelling is such an important part of this, especially when it comes to communicating science. Having opportunities for that to be a part of the curriculum was explored in this workshop too, to promote you know, how we can, you know, bring our own personal storytelling, what we experience ourselves, in addition to what we find within our respective fields, as part of the overarching climate education. And so this, again, this paper is here if you want more information. We also talked about mental health, which is a big part of this conversation for many students and faculty as well, when we talk about eco-anxiety and climate grief, how that can impact communities. Many faith-based knowledges, for example, have ways to process those things, such as climate grief and eco-anxiety. And so I'll finish it here with this last slide. We really appreciate the time and happy to answer any questions. We also have our respective contact information here as well. So thank you. Any questions? Yes, Katie?
Could you talk a little bit more
So with my example, for instance, for this slide, yeah. So this workshop brought both professors at the collegiate level, but then also academics in K through 12 education. So secondary, elementary school, for example. I don't know what the exact breakdown was, but I believe that there were small groups amongst those various categories or stages rather of education to have a conversation about, you know, what can be done to promote inclusive education. They shared a lot of, you know, reflecting on the students that they've, you know, experienced before and some of the concerns that were brought up and either the lack of inclusive education by students who, you know, come from a faith-based background or indigenous background. How can they, you know, feel comfortable sharing this part of their way of knowing in addition to what is being taught in the curriculum as well? And so they talked about several strategies, whether that is providing inclusive language in the syllabus, in the curriculum itself, that promotes students who subscribe to many systems of knowing to provide a sense of comfort that they can share that and they won't be discredited for that in any ways. There were conversations on, you know, how can we transform or have multiple methodologies to communicating and teaching climate science than just, you know, NEM graphs and charts, but is there art or are there other ways that students, well, not only in the classroom, but outside of the classroom too, like on a field trip, for example, where they can explore and be more in tune with their way of knowing. For example, if they go out and do a nature walk and they experience in real time what they feel more connected with, that just subscribes with their way of knowing as well. The paper provides more details, so I would encourage looking into that too. It was a variety of activity. And then in terms of the demographic with the students that were there, I'm not entirely sure, but it was more oriented towards faculty.
Any other questions?
We have two.
So I was thinking, I really like the way you compared biodiversity with human diversity and flourishing. And I know in many Christian communities, there's a thought that that climate science is woke and not real and political, but maybe biodiversity doesn't sound as scary. Is that something that you could build on more in church settings to help bridge a path into talking more climate science?
Yeah, I've been testing that out for the last couple of years. And admittedly, a church that's going to be more open to Episcopalian, but within upstate South Carolina, so pretty conservative congregation for the Episcopal Church. And I found that when I stopped talking about climate and stopped using sciencey words, there was, especially because it's a more rural area there, and there's a lot of people with either a farming background or other rural traditional industry background, that I got a lot more buy-in. So I think, yeah, talking about biodiversity instead of saying things like systemic change, which I don't say in that kind of environment, I talk about, hey, have you noticed that your soil systems are changing? What are you noticing there? And I'm like, how does that play with the amount of rainfall you're getting? Which is another system, it's a hydrological system. And so I think that using inclusive language within that setting matters.
Question in the back.
Oh yeah, thank you very much. So Sharon and Carlos, you're both AAAS policy fellows, right? And you're both at the National
Nicholas can give you details on his because it's explicitly involved. For me, I'm on the Includes Initiative, which is multi-agency and cross-director at NSF, and we do funding for, and I've got literature if anybody wants it later, for broadening participation challenges, including faith communities. We've had some of those apply. We have a number of TCUs involved in HBCUs as well, where we're trying to ensure that they create systemic change by setting up unique broadening participation goals.
And then just to really quickly, for myself, so I'm in the Geosciences Directorate, which is, you know, climate, weather, you name it. I have, you know, presented this type of work at that directorate to talk about the importance of broadening participation of all systems of knowing in the geoscience enterprise. And there has been positive receptivity there. And so there's ongoing conversations about how to promote inclusive language of multiple ways of knowing, promote the ability for example, theological serving institutions to apply to an NSF grant or be a co-PI or a sub-awardee of a academic institution that they're working with in addition. So there's ongoing conversations, and there fortunately hasn't been a lot of pushback because they see this as it's not particular to one religion, it's multi-spiritual, multi-faith. And they also see this already ongoing with indigenous spirituality anyways, and the work that's ongoing, for example, in the Arctic with many programs that they're working with many indigenous communities. And you can't work with communities or indigenous communities without the spiritual conversation and that kind of relationship that is required of.
And one more note on that, the NSF recently changed its PAPCHI, its guide to applying for grants, to mandate that if you want to do work within an indigenous community's territory, as long as it's a federally recognized tribe, I recognize the problems and limitations of that, that you must get agreement from the tribal government in a signed letter and that they must be involved and have data sovereignty. Sorry, insider bawling. Tribal colleges and universities, yeah. Because we're at time,
yeah,
I will talk to you offline, but yes, and I will tell you how to find it.